Hello, and thank you for joining this HCP Live Medcast series, Drying, Durability, and Disease Control: Evolving Metrics of Anti-VEGF Success in Retinal Diseases. My name is Dr. Hassan Rahimi. I'm a retina specialist practicing in the San Francisco Bay Area.
My name is Dr. David Miller, practicing with Retina Associates of Cleveland in Cleveland, Ohio, and I'm happy to join the team here.
In this episode, we explore the importance of retinal drying as a key marker of treatment effectiveness and discuss how fluid management strategies vary between AMD and DME. We also examine the concept of sustained disease control and compare the drying effects and durability of next-generation anti-VEGF therapies. Joining us today in this discussion is my good friend, Dr. Esther Kim. Welcome, Esther.
Hi, Asan and David. So nice to be here with you guys. I am practicing at Orange County Retina here in Orange County, California.
Fantastic. So looking forward to this vibrant discussion. Thank you for joining us. Let's dive right in. Esther, I'm going to start with sort of a philosophical question, if you will. Humor me. Why is achieving retinal drying considered such a critical marker of treatment effectiveness in retinal diseases?
You know, that's actually a really good question. I think there are a lot of things that we take for granted. Sometimes, you know, you do a lot of teaching. It takes a medical student, a resident, or a fellow to be like, why are we doing that? And it makes you pause and reflect and, you know, challenge those underlying assumptions. So, retinal drying has been corroborated in numerous studies in showing to be, you know, the absence of fluid is corroborated with better vision. So I think that's always been the holy grail for us as retina specialists is getting the retina dry and eradicating fluid, generally speaking, in all layers as much as possible in order to achieve the best visual outcomes.
Totally agree. I mean, I think, as you stated, we use the anatomy and the drying effect as our surrogate for vision, because as much as I'd want to trust the reliability, it's tough to reproduce visual acuity testing from a visit-to-visit basis in the real world, as we know.
Isan, just to interrupt for a second, do you think, how has your view of that evolved over the years in terms of how dry is dry enough, or what is something you'll tolerate, depending on disease state or other factors?
Yeah, I think that's what this discussion is going to kind of evolve into, is how we compartmentalize, like, okay, how much fluid is okay? Where is that fluid? Is it intraretinal fluid? Is it subretinal fluid? What's our tolerance to these? I think it depends largely on the condition that we're treating. To your point, I'd say when we look at the anti-VEGF or the injection game, we're several innings into it now, where A, it's very hard to beat what we have in terms of efficacy with VEGF. Numerous other compounds have tried and failed. And so I think that leads to B, the lower hanging fruit in terms of, drug development and making progress in our field has been extended durability. Can we achieve comparable outcomes to what we were getting with VEGF, but do it with less frequent, less intensive, less invasive therapies over time? I think that's where the field is right now. And as we'll discuss, 8 mg aflibercept, faricimab, this next generation class of drugs is hopefully a step in that direction. Nothing's perfect though, right? Like, in our attempt to be able to extend longer, I think we have to be a little bit more willing to tolerate a little bit less of this drying effect, hence the question. So, I mean, with that said, do you guys find in your practice, are you more tolerant to having a little bit of intraretinal fluid or subretinal fluid? Does one matter more than the other? Does the underlying disease state matter more? Open floor to you guys.
I guess I was thinking, nothing's better than a completely dry OCT scan. Those are the best, right? You don't have to think too hard about it. Wow, this is working perfectly, and I can probably give this injection less often and march out our duration. It's when there's a little bit of fluid there, but the vision's doing great, and how many weeks out am I, and how many visits has this been the exact same, and you have to do some calculus, and kind of decide that the art part of medicine there about trying to move forward. But the trials done most recently with these longer acting new anti-VEGF agents give us some confidence that maybe we can do that. Esther, your thoughts?
That's a great question. I think a great segue. I think historically speaking, we have sort of chased after every little bit of fluid. Personally, I'm reluctant to extend when I see fluid on the scan, even if the vision hasn't dropped, because oftentimes the anatomical changes can precede those vision changes. But that said, as you have stated in the trials, they often did tolerate, 50 microns of fluid, plus or minus had to have vision changes. So perhaps the need to be so critical about every drop of fluid may not be as mandatory as before. I think that in general, like you said, we want as bone dry of a retina as possible, but at what cost is that coming? Like, is the patient having to come Q4? Are you not, are you locked into a certain treatment paradigm? Is the patient developing treatment fatigue? And then you're trying to add GA drugs on top of it. I mean, it's like there's always kind of a give and take. So I think that the treatment paradigm for me may be shifting a little bit to where I am tolerating an AMD, some subretinal fluid, and then certainly for DME, some intraretinal fluid outside of the fovea and/or central involving DME, but with a VA of 20/25 or better, as was suggested by the DRC or NET protocol V results.
You're hinting at that, Esther, and just to get it out there, do your thresholds for tolerating intraretinal or subretinal fluid differ depending on the underlying condition that you're treating? I mean, I think generally speaking, we think intraretinal fluid is worse for visual prognosis, right? And I think we've seen some of these studies. I think fluid study comes to mind where they say, suggests at least that if you have stable subretinal fluid, you probably hopefully won't compromise long-term visual acuity outcomes. Does that translate to your clinical practice?
Yeah, it does. And also, the thought that some subretinal fluid might be protective, it's sort of the retina's attempt to heal itself. It means that you're alive, you're trying to fight the good fight, right? Instead of just being like bone dry and dead, so to speak. So I think in some cases, that subretinal fluid, we all have those patients who have like great vision, and that subretinal fluid really never goes away despite regular injections.
Let's go through a quick practice because I think we all have these type of patients where we're injecting and Davey alluded to this, they get mostly dry, but they still have residual fluid, like a little bit of subretinal fluid. How aggressively do each of you treat that to try to achieve quote unquote complete fluid resolution? Like walk me through that type of patient. Are you tightening intervals? Are you switching to different agents? Like how much are you exhausting this until you accept that, okay, maybe this is a little bit of fluid that I can tolerate?
I think Esther had some really good points there a couple of minutes ago, depending on the patients and a few examples that we can touch on again. But when we're starting out therapy, I still like to see that OCT go completely dry if at all possible. So we look at like the loading dose paradigm that's on the label and whether you have to follow it or not. Well, if the OCT is not dried out completely, I find myself still following the label, right? So I'm kind of doing it based on the OCT response. But if they dry out, after one shot, I don't know that I have to give the next shot for the label. I can maybe start extending right there. But if there is residual fluid and they're a new patient, to anti-VEGF therapy, I'm willing to try and really get my maximum effect with the anti-VEGF and then stretching out and cautiously stretching out from there. Especially with the visual acuity being stable. And then, like Esther mentioned, you look at some of the diseases like diabetic macular edema, fovea involved, some cystic fluid right at the fovea with visual acuity at 20/25. We've all seen those patients sit like that for like years, it seems sometimes. It's amazing, right? And long as that's not getting worse and their vision's not dropping, you can get pretty comfortable there too and stretching those patients out.
Okay.
Two examples.
So the concept of sustained disease control has just been gaining traction in our field over the last few years. I think as we're getting retina specialists comfortable with the idea of extended durability agents, what exactly does this term sustained disease control actually mean to you guys? And what kind of impact does it have on defining what long-term treatment success means for your patients and you as providers? Esther, why don't you go first?
So in the article that coined the term, the Nature article that coined the term sustained disease control, it is inclusive of three factors. One is eradicating fluid, but also vision and also durability. So I think that historically, we'd always just done the drying component, right? You know, like in clinical trials, the gold standard, the control arm was Q4, just lockstep, because that's really the only way to get the retina as bone dry as possible with the drugs that we had at that time. But now, you know, like Eisan had alluded to before, I think we're getting greedy. Like fluid drying, it's almost a given. Like drugs like aflibercept have really, it's a blockbuster drug, truly. It's become the standard of care. I think that we have, as retina specialists, it makes us look really good because even just with a single shot, I mean, patients are turned right around. But now that we have that, we're kind of not satisfied with just being dry. We don't want patients to be stuck at Q4, Q6 week intervals. I think we're looking for more. And the next stage of that really is to get more durability. So I think with all of the newer trials, with faricimab, with high dose aflibercept, we're really looking at, okay, vision, drying, it's a given, but how far can we stretch these patients? Like in some ways, how much fluid could we tolerate? To get back to your question earlier, you know, I do like to treat the patient till they are bone dry, ideally, just so I know what sort of the best potential vision is. But if they like really aren't changed at all, the visual acuity is the same, they subjectively feel stable, then I might loosen a little bit, you know, add 2 weeks or extend 2 to 4 weeks, you know, as long as the vision isn't dropping, and that might guide some of my treatment as well. But I do like to get them at some point to bone dry just so I know that what vision is possible and what I might be leaving on the table if I tolerated some fluid from the get-go.
Yeah, and you know, to tack on to that, for me at least, the fourth pillar of sustained disease control is the subjective feeling of the patient themselves, and that kind of gets in line with what you're saying. I think we all have examples of patients who we can treat and get them bone dry just to prove that it's possible, but then subjectively, whether they go a couple of extra weeks or not in between their injections, some patients don't really notice that difference, and they would opt to try to go an extra month or 2 months or 3 months, even though their anatomy maybe doesn't look as dry as it typically does, but everything else subjectively feels okay to them. I think this speaks to the art of medicine. You're all nodding. I imagine you have similar patients like this where, you know, it's almost like every visit is sort of a negotiation or a deal to try to get their visits to go out a little bit longer as well.
So, Eisan, you
Right.
just
And
recoined it, you know, perceived sustained disease
perceived.
control.
You know, the trial for the aflibercept 8 milligram versus the 2 milligram, when you looked at the central retinal thickness, right, and how sustained was it after the loading dose injection going out 8 weeks, and you can definitely see the newer agents having quite a benefit. You know, the bounce back in the edema isn't nearly as pronounced. Again, not a primary endpoint for the trial, but certainly matches up with what I've seen in my clinical practice, and I was wondering if you've noticed similar things in your practice, Isan and Esther.
Yet, just for the audience, I think what you're referring to give some context, is that secondary analysis, the quartile analysis from the PHOTON study. I thought that was
Right.
very impressive. Obviously, it's not pre-specified. You can't really, you know, you can interpret from it whatever you will. It's subjective. It's not anything definitive. But that being stated, when they did this quartile analysis and they looked at the thickest retinas, right? I believe they had like starting CST of like greater than 530 microns. After the loading doses, and remember, 8 milligram and PHOTON only got 3 monthly loading doses. 2 milligram got its on-label 5, so it had 2 less loading doses. But then, over the subsequent 8 weeks, where an injection wasn't provided, you had essentially way less of a rebound. And essentially, if I recall, the average CST held serve, it was pretty much, you know, zero in terms of the difference. Whereas with 2 milligram, after the 5 loading doses, you had almost a rebound effect of close to like 57, 58 microns. And yeah, that
Right.
really sticks out to me. And I try to translate that into my clinical practice, at least when I have these conversations with patients, to mean I feel like for some of my patients, extended dosing, you know, interval possible treatments like 8 milligram of aflibercept is almost like a little bit of a security blanket. Not all of these patients actually want to test the boundaries. Some of them just tell me I'm happy to stay around my injection interval I was at before, maybe a little bit longer, but just knowing that I have this built-in durability in case real life happens, especially like we see it for our AMD patients, our diabetics, They can get hospitalized, they can have heart attacks, they can have, unexpected medical events, need surgeries, whatnot. And we see, I think we tend to see this more with the diabetic population. We tell them come back in 4 weeks, it ends up being 8. You tell them come back in 8, they oftentimes come back at 12 or 16. So at least that's how I interpret that quartile analysis when I try to translate it to my clinical practice. Like, oh, this is a little bit of just built-in durability when real life happens and these patients are potentially going to go longer unexpectedly, that I'm not going to lose everything that we've worked so hard to gain. What do you think, Esther?
Yeah, I think that's perfectly well put. I mean, as you were saying that, a patient from today comes to mind where he's a diabetic, he's working, he actually works at a primary care clinic down the block. But I was like, wow, the fluid, the DME really came back. And I was like, whoa, the last injection was 5 months ago. I don't know how that got away from us. Like between scheduling PRP visits and his injection in the other eye, like, so I actually switched him to high dose of aflibercept today. From Avastin, which was originally mandated per his insurance. But I think that, like, exactly like you said, it just kind of builds in that buffer. I think sometimes the label scares people off because you have to make that sort of jump from Q4 to Q7 to 8 weeks, starting with the fourth dose. But I do feel like it's rarely let me down, honestly. I mean, like, very, 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 very seldomly. I think that also, sometimes people will have patients come back 4 weeks after the third injection just to see. But I really think that's premature because if you just waited another 4 weeks, i.e., 8 weeks after the third injection, you'll see that the fluid is continuing to decline. So it is still working, in the background, as you'd alluded to, David, as well. I mean, I think that these drugs really have an additional staying power, which is very, it is different from what we've had before, and it is making a difference, I think, in my practice and as well as in my patients. What about you, David? What are your thoughts?
I would completely agree. It's certainly making an impact, and treatment burden is certainly less, and the confidence that I can express to the patient that, hey, I think we're going to be fine going another 2 weeks. And it's been really a nice evolution in the field to have these more durable agents and getting out to things. Such as 12 and even 16 weeks, and still getting a recurrence past 16. So sometimes you play with it and you find these patients do recur, like you mentioned, at 5 months. The disease is still active. And you're like, okay, we're not really done, but maybe it's not going to be that often. And even if you drop to a PRN status, perhaps, when you get really far out there in a diabetic in particular. But it can be very impactful, certainly both in the clinic volume burden and also the patient burden of being retreated.
Esther, your case example, I think, brings up an interesting question because I feel like we're at the stage of it post-launch where colleagues are entertaining this more often now, which is either how often are you using it first line when you're able to, or if you have to do Avastin first, like, are you introducing or incorporating high dose of aflibercept just much earlier on in your treatment regimen for these conditions, whether it's diabetes or AMD, or just kind of walk me through your process. Walk me through your escalation of switching agents and whether or not you're finding that you want to incorporate these stronger agents sooner than before. At least for me personally, I find that I kind of want to, like, I want to start now more with my bazooka rather than just saving it in the background for, like, 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years from now. But I'm curious, what do you think?
I mean, you and I have very similar mentalities. I think that I probably reach for the branded drug as soon as possible. Like, even in treatment naive patients would be the ideal case. Because, like you said, I think overall it's going to reduce the treatment burden. Like, if you look at the 3-year outcomes, just looking at, say, aflibercept HD, of the patients who the number of injections or how they were able to be randomized to the Q20, 24-week intervals, that happened much sooner for the patients who were on 8 milligrams from the get-go versus those who were on 2 milligrams and then re-randomized to the 8 milligrams. So I think overall there is a cost savings, to the patient, to society, arguably. I mean, I haven't run the numbers, but I think that, kind of waiting to switch is costly, both in terms of, like, patients, the patients outcomes in terms of the amount of chair time that you have to spend. That's a whole nother conversation. Instead of just starting with sort of your best player, out of the gates, it's like, why bench LeBron? I'm from LA, Lakers. So, like, why would you bench him if he could just play every minute of every game and not be fatigued? Like, get out there, LeBron. I'm not going to save you for the last quarter, right? Like, you're not a closer. Like, I want you playing every minute out there on the field. So that's kind of, definitely how I view it. And sorry, one other thing, but like the DRC or protocol AC, I think that was the one where they looked at, starting on bevacizumab first versus aflibercept and how many ended up needing to be switched over. It was a very, very high percentage. It was a majority of patients. So I do think many of our patients are needing to switch over, be it for efficacy or durability. So if you can just accomplish that from the get-go, that's saving yourself and the patient headache, chair time, and I think the number of injections given on the whole.
Yeah,
I would completely agree. I never understood if I got a disease or an issue that's time critical and wet AMD being more time critical than DME, we can all agree. But even DME, I'm not sure I want the macula swollen an extra 3 to 4 months and not being in control. I've really migrated to starting with aflibercept, 8 milligram, right out of the gate, barring insurance restrictions, right? And there's step edits we all deal with, and there's the have to start with one of bevacizumab and maybe one aflibercept at 2 milligrams. So that one I really don't get. Why I'm being a step edited through a branded drug of the same drug at a lower dose, with less durability, right? My preference would be to really, put your best player out there first and get control,
Yeah,
right?
I love the LeBron analogy. I think I'm gonna have to use that. I'm gonna use Steph Curry up here.
I was gonna say,
Definitely that
yeah.
story with my patients because I think it
That's
really
where the rubber met the road.
resonates. I think part of this is us challenging the way we were trained. Like this is paradigm shifting in a way, right? And at least, Esther and I trained around the same time. My mentors constantly would quote rise and ride because we would see this slow, gradual gain over 24 months, and that was for ranibizumab. And the teaching was always, especially with DME, is just like, just keep injecting, just keep injecting. The function lags behind the form. You'll slowly, slowly get there. And I think that's the way a lot of us treat our practices, especially because it's tough to keep changing things as we go, and you usually just end up sticking with whatever you stick with along the way. But especially now that we have these newer, stronger drugs, I'm totally on board with what you guys said. I go with the best right off the bat as soon as I can, and I found that it's surprising, not maybe not surprisingly, it's working out quite well in my practice, and really helping these patients to achieve optimal outcomes with reduced treatment burden. Absolutely. So it's not just aflibercept 8 milligrams, right? When we're talking about these next generation agents, we also have faricimab as well too. Esther, could you compare, at least in your clinical practice, the drying effect of faricimab to maybe you could do to 2 milligram of aflibercept, but then also transition it to now that we have 8 milligrams out, how they compare in your practice, and where does each fit in terms of your treatment regimens?
I think they're both really, really phenomenal agents. I think some ways in which faricimab may be a distinguishing factor in my mind is, faricimab's been up for longer. So the Genentech's had the opportunity to do a lot more post-hoc analyses and looking at sort of secondary endpoints, so to speak, like vascular leakage, as evidence on FA, anti-fibrotic effects, be that say in a diabetic, less ERM formation, or the holy grail would be anti-fibrosis in a condition like wet AMD. But I think that faricimab certainly has stood out, compared to aflibercept 2 milligrams in those trials as really having a tangible difference. And to me, that's exciting. It's like a different biomarker, it's a different endpoint. Like that Ang-2 effect may be different, from just the old VEGF inhibition. So in those cases where I, see a lot of leakage, or if I see that really spongy DME that's diffuse, those are patients that I'm often more wanting to try faricimab on. Also, like for anti-fibrotic effects, I have a lady with like this tiny sub retinal fibrosis, and that's really just causing her vision to just be declined right at the fovea. And I'm like, you know, let's give the faricimab a try. Like, insurance allows it. What have we got to lose? There might be some additional gain there. So those are some exciting things, and I look forward to, I think the company is kind of continuing to explore these kind of analyses as well, as these factors may also help guide the decision making of which drug to reach for next.
You've hinted at a couple of these, but I mean, are there other patient-specific characteristics or, disease-specific characteristics or imaging-based biomarkers that you're looking for that make you want to reach for one or the other, or that potentially seem to correlate to better durability overall when you're treating patients?
That's a hard one because I wish, you know, there was some clear cut thing, right? I feel like, in my mind, I feel like HD is basically the better than 2 milligrams. So in the cases bread and butter, you know, where I would have done 2 milligrams, why do the 2 milligrams that we as alluded to, as insurance allows, I would do the 8 milligrams. It saves us all a step, you know, and it gets us the best durability possible. I think especially in like recalcitrant patients, right? Especially those who have been stuck at those Q4 week intervals, I'm not gonna really reach for the HD in those cases because of the label restrictions where I can't do more often than Q7, because that to me is not gonna be a true apples to apples, you know, fight for this patient. I'm gonna put that patient on faricimab where I have the luxury of being able to dose as frequently as I want, and that includes Q4. So I think for those really recalcitrant patients where I'm really looking for something different, like a different pathway, right? Instead of just a higher molar concentration of VEGF inhibition, I want that Ang-2 effect, which may be working on different pathways and maybe having a different effect. I certainly am going to reach for faricimab more in those cases. And I think even just, you know, for treatment naive, faricimab is also excellent just because it does give me that Q4 weeks flexibility in the, like I alluded to, the rare event that after the third loading dose, I wouldn't feel confident extending the patient.
A hypothetical question for HD. So I think retina specialists, we're a funny group. We take clinical outcomes and then we'll justify it with, molecular targets and pathways when we don't know for sure if that's what's going on, right? But clearly,
Sure.
we all have the patients. We switch to faricimab. We see a really, exciting response, as you say, and it invites potentially speculation or you're theorizing like, okay, this is Ang-2 at play or VEGF. I think we've also equally seen cases now that 8 milligram of aflibercept is out, where I've had patients not respond well to faricimab or lose their response to faricimab that I've switched to 8 milligram and get a better response. And I guess I'd ask you guys to speculate, why do you guys think that is? Is this VEGF driven? Is this just unique to the aflibercept molecule? Is it sequestering, other factors that we know it does? It just doesn't, I don't think is a primary point of focus. David, Esther, like, what do you guys think
Yeah,
about that?
you're right. Those patients that flip back and forth or have been on both agents, and even some that I actually have alternating at 4 week intervals, right? Because the insurance companies will let us do that. You get both approved, and now you got one at now they're both being used at 8 weeks, Q8. So they're getting something every 4 weeks, and sometimes that's worked. But I think my experience on that is so, anecdotal. I really don't get my head too caught up in that and try and extrapolate to more generalizations. It's kind of like whatever's working a little bit, right? I don't think too hard about it, knowing I'm in a small little sampling. One thing we did do in our group, we took all the patients injected over a month and tracked out their next injections based on drugs between bevacizumab, aflibercept, 8 milligrams, and faricimab. And that was interesting because now you got over 1,000 patients, 2,000 patients in each group just in that 1 month. We took them out for the next 3 months and saw when the next injection was. We did find separators in the days between intervals across. Of course, it's not a clean study, it's very sloppy, but just to lumping it all in with those big numbers, which patients had the least frequent injection for the next injection compared to the other drugs. And it actually came out with significant p values, though the days weren't that big, 8 days, 6 days between bevacizumab and faricimab and aflibercept, maybe 3 days, but all had p values, surprisingly. And it's across all the disease states. So again, very sloppy, not controlled, but for some reason, the docs in my group are injecting the aflibercept maybe a little less often than the other agents across all diseases. So sometimes you can, like that type of data to me, I can get my head around saying maybe there's something there, right? But the anecdotal stuff, it's tough to put too much thought into it. You drive yourself kind of crazy a little bit, you know?
I will play devil's advocate with your study, though. I was like, with the Vabysmo, again, because you have that ability to dose Q4 to 6.
Right. All
So
right.
maybe it's self-selecting, like you're going to use it on that really recalcitrant patient who just wasn't able to get
Right.
from Q4. In that case, Q6 is like a huge win, right? We all have those patients who are elated just to have a couple more weeks between visits. It really adds up over the years.
Right. And those two drugs actually were pretty tight. There was a P value, but literally it was a number of days. It was really surprising to me they could be so close and still be separable. But you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, in line with that, Esther, like, while all these clinical trials, Tenaya, Lucerne, Yosemite, Rhine, Pulsar, Photon, they show that many of these patients can extend their treatment-free intervals to 12, 16 weeks at a time. We still know in the real world, there's other patients who need just more frequent dosing. Are there any patient or disease-specific factors, again, that you think contribute to this? Like, why do we see such a variability with what we get in the trials versus what we're seeing on a day-to-day basis in our clinics?
If we could just identify those biomarkers, of patients who are going to be able to extend versus those not, I think sometimes we get a flavor, right? Like when you see that new patient and the OCT looks like a train wreck, you just have it in your mind. Like they have really large PEDs, they have hyperreflective foci, this looks kind of chronic, the vision is way down. You see some fibrosis forming. I think those features to me suggest like a poor visual prognosis and or a response versus that patient with a cute little SRF or just a tiny little bit of intraretinal fluid, the vision didn't change much. That one you feel like is going to be a little bit more of a hole in one. But I feel like we've seen patients go both ways where you think this should be pretty straightforward, and yet there's that chronic subretinal fluid. Or you have another patient who is a train wreck but has like a phenomenal response, especially to these newer agents. So it is a little bit hard to predict. But I do like that the drugs give us the confidence in knowing that we're sort of giving them the best that modern science has to offer.
How do you set your patient expectations when you're starting a new therapy? Like, give me your spiel. Give me a LeBron-esque type of spiel to wrap this up.
Well, I don't like to overwhelm patients with like forever. It's like if you, my husband tells me all of my analogies are relationship related, and many are. But it's kind of like you just met somebody and you're like, so are you going to marry this person or not? You're like, whoa, like I can't think about forever right now. I literally just met you. Can we just go on a few dates and see how it goes? So I don't like to overwhelm the patient with like, you are going to be on this forever, dun dun dun, right? So I tell them, about the loading doses that we're going to do monthly, and then I just tell them that we're going to extend, and hopefully if things are textbook, we're able to extend you like out to 4 months even, would be ideal. If things are looking worse, we may have to take a step back and reduce the interval, but I am always open to try to re-extending the interval. Nothing is set in stone. And I just kind of leave it more of a like, let's see how it goes sort of thing, right? And I also always try to remain hopeful in terms of like, there's gene therapy in the works. There are implants that surgically place implants that are an option for those patients who really do not want to get the injections. So there are other options, and this is a very active area of research where this is what we have for now, but it may not be at this cadence forever. So just kind of easing them into it, instead of being like, this is it and you're doomed, which can feel pretty.
Right.
Very,
That's
very
a great
well said.
answer.
Yeah,
Great
that's
answer. Yeah.
great clinical pearls and great life advice for relationships. Thank you, Esther.
Right.
You will turn a somebody off that way for sure. And they could have been the one.
absolutely agree. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have today. I mean, Esther, thank you. This has been a very entertaining conversation, very enlightening. I hope you guys enjoyed yourselves. I've learned a lot, and to our viewers. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you for our next episode.